Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today on this Friday Eve. I know, shouldn't rush things, so happy Thursday, everybody. Enjoy your day. We are privileged to have with us today to get us caught up on what's going on with the Florida legislature, as well as some other topics, including celebrating her as part of Women's History Month. Florida State Senator Geraldine Thompson from District 15. Good morning, Senator Thompson. Are you there? Oh, okay. She's coming. I just got a note from her aide that she is going to be on with us. They just wrapped up, I think, was it 8 weeks of the legislative session, and she's going to get us caught up. She does have a newsletter, by the way, so, you know, make sure you sign up to kind of keep up on what's going on. They've talked about bills with regards to energy resources, mental health, substance abuse, and a variety of other things. So we're pleased to have her with us. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm blessed. How are you, ma'am?
Doing well. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you taking the time out today. So it's been quite a busy time, I guess, a challenging time with the legislative session. Can you give us, I guess, a little bit of a wrap-up in terms of how things went, what went well, what, you know, concerns are still on the table? Wherever you want to start is great.
Okay. Well, there weren't a whole lot of things, in my opinion, that were good for the people of Florida. We're still focusing on culture wars rather than dealing with affordable housing and rising property insurance rates and education, all of those things. Some of the things that were very troubling for me had to do with, again, culture wars. And we had a bill that passed out of the legislature that indicated that teachers who are preparing to go into the classroom cannot share any information about systemic racism, sexism, oppression, those kinds of things. And as a former educator, I know that teacher preparation involves methodology, how to be an effective teacher. It involves strategies. It does not involve that kind of content. If you want to take a course in history, you go to the history department, not to the Department of Education. I pointed those things out, but the bill passed. Another very troubling piece of legislation would prohibit local governments from putting in place ordinances that would ensure that people who work outside and are exposed to the extreme Florida heat would be given shade, water, and rest breaks. So now local governments are preempted from putting those kinds of ordinances in place, I imagine because employers who have people who work outside, who focus on folks on the roof, people laying the sod outside, doing the lawn, farm workers, I guess they imagine that they'll make more money if they don't have to give people water, shade, and rest breaks. So that seemed to me one of the most cruel pieces of legislation, as well as a bill that would now require local government to move people who are sleeping on public property, whether that's a park or let's say at the library, a public place. They would mm-hmm. remove those people, and they would have to put them in an encampment. So I question whether there's going to be security. Is there going to be security at these encampments? Will people have food and water and restrooms? And none of those questions were answered. And I pointed out that when you require that local governments do something and you provide no funding, it's an unfunded mm-hmm. mandate. So that's essentially what that bill amounts to. But now local governments can be fined if people are sleeping on public property. So those are some of the kinds of things that we dealt with rather than trying to address the problems that Floridians face on an everyday basis. One of the bills that did pass that I was pleased to see passed, it wasn't comprehensive enough, was a bill to increase the number of health care workers. Because as Florida's population grows, there are more people who need health care. So we will be funding an increase for training nurses and for physicians who are in residency programs. Filed an amendment to that bill that would have expanded Medicaid because no matter how many professionals are available, if you can't afford to pay for it, it doesn't help. But the Medicaid portion was not considered, but the bill passed, and I think that is a positive with regard to access to more healthcare professionals. So we had 60 days in Tallahassee. And some of the things that I was able to do was to pass a bill that will create a specialty license plate to focus on the threat of overdose, which is becoming prevalent in the state of Florida. And so the specialty license plate, the proceeds from the sale of the plate, would go to a nonprofit called Project Addiction. And they will provide counseling and services who are recovering. Also, it would focus on the stigma that people still face in recovery. Even though they're no longer using or abusing, they face a stigma. So I was able to get that specialty license plate passed, which will bring some revenue to that organization. And I was able to get an expansion of the people who are eligible to buy a Divine Nine specialty license plate. Right now, the only people who can buy those plates are people who are members and can prove that they are members of one of the Divine Nine organizations. And what I was able to do was to expand it to family members who could show, let's say, a birth certificate, a marriage certificate, or something. They can now buy the plate for the member. So that's going to increase the sale of that plate, and 85% of the sale of the Divine Nine plate will go to those organizations for scholarships for students in Florida. And I was able to get an expansion of people who are qualified for the Okoye Descendants Scholarship. Right now it's only for public institutions. And there are many people who want to go to historically black colleges and universities, our HBCUs. So now
it
will be expanded, and individuals will be able to take those dollars and fund their education at an HBCU.
You talked about some good things. One thing actually just really hit me for a variety of reasons, and that is the bill that you talked about the outdoor workers.
Yes.
Being in Florida, you know, practically all my life, with the exception of the first 2 years of my life, you know, it's first of all, how hot it can get in general. We have climate change. We have a larger population and a large portion of those who work outdoors in those areas that those locations that you were talking about, including road construction, which that is a growing industry. We are in need of more housing. We can provide legislation that says, okay, if you work 4 hours, you get a 15-minute break. I think that's part of the labor laws if you're working inside. Outdoor workers need better protections. That just seems kind of inhumane that these things are not being thought about, because what's going to happen when these people start getting sick from whether it's heat stroke or it's inhaling toxins in the environment because they're out working, let's say, around tar and gravel and all that kind of stuff all day, or whatever the case may be. When they come up with those diseases and the medical bills start piling up, you know, part of it is going to end up on us anyway. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely right. And we have laws in place in Florida to protect athletes who are training and practicing outside. We must give them water. If they get overheated, there must be a tub available full of ice so that they can immerse themselves and bring their temperature down. So it would seem to me that we're valuing athletes more than we value the workers who are exposed to the Florida sun. And your point about the heat exposure and the heat-related illnesses, those are people for the most part who are uninsured or they're underinsured, mm-hmm. and they end up in our emergency rooms. When you go mm-hmm. to the emergency room, you will be treated. The law says that you have to be treated. And that is the most expensive form of health care that you can access. If these individuals, and this is why I was trying to get the Medicaid expanded, because if these individuals had a primary care physician and focused on prevention rather than waiting until they're critically ill and going to the emergency room, it would save the state of Florida a great deal of money.
Some of what you talked about that got passed, including this, seems to be without some sort of foresight or forethought and doesn't seem to come with a backup plan. So my thing is, if you put something in place, you need to look at what the ramifications are in case it doesn't work. Or if you negate something, you need to come with an alternative plan before you just say, no, that's not a good idea. Am I wrong in this thinking?
Well, you're not wrong, but what the state of Florida has done, particularly with regard to heat exposure, they are now saying that OSHA, which is a federal agency, that OSHA is responsible for enforcing these laws rather than the state. Now, this is the same state administration that wanted to get rid of OSHA and did not want to abide by OSHA's regulations, but now they're saying OSHA is the agency that will enforce the laws with regard to heat exposure. So it's passing the buck and kicking the can down the road. And this is not something that I see the federal government doing as effectively state government could do, because we're right here on the ground.
We are here with Florida State Senator Geraldine Thompson of District 15. And if you have questions or comments, the number is 516-387-1944. We're going to take a quick break. G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We'll be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Having a wedding, reception, family reunion, planning a banquet, or some other fundraising event. Need to share your knowledge through a workshop or seminar, or it's a difficult time and you need to plan a wake or repast. let us help. At our gatherings, let us reduce the stress and make the occasion memorable, treasured. Call our gatherings at 407-968-9387 or email ourgatherings@yahoo.com. Let us help plan your special event.
Good morning and welcome back to G's Power Hour. I never had it so good entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are blessed and privileged to have with us this morning Florida State Senator Geraldine Thompson of District 15. They just wrapped up the legislative session in Tallahassee with some, you know, good things, some not so good things. And so we're getting caught up with her. So what is your, I guess, game plan now going forward in terms of some of the things that did not get accomplished this time around?
Well, I'm running for re-election, and I will be on the ballot in August of 2024, and there are only two candidates right now. We're both Democrats, so unless a Republican or other person gets in, this race will be the third.
Okay.
I will be refiling some of the bills that I filed before. One of the bills that was a priority for me was to require that anyone who transports a child 6 years or under would have a device that would attach to the car seat. The car seat is already required. So this device is like a sensor, and it would be triggered by weight on the car seat, and at the end of your trip, it's synced with your smartphone. So at the end of your trip, if the weight does not decrease, it means that you have forgotten a child or something, and that would help us address the increasing number of children who are dying from being left in hot cars. That bill was not even heard. And so my plan would be to refile it as soon as the election is over, because these deaths are preventable, and they're not deliberate. People don't, you know, deliberately children. But you have instances where children have been left in the driveway in a car, and in Florida, going back to the heat, the temperature rises very quickly. And some people are under the misconception that if they crack the windows, that's going to be helpful. But the glass, the windshield, radiates the heat, and it rises very quickly. And we had a situation here in Orange County where a father was asked to take his child to daycare. He agreed to do that. His wife normally did it. And he puts the child in the car seat, and he's on autopilot, and he goes to work. Goes into his workplace, comes out at the end of the day, and, of course, the child is deceased. So those kinds of things, just a little reminder, the alert to say the weight hasn't decreased, check the back seat. Now, newer cars already have that. Federal government required that there be an alarm that says check the back seat. But this is for the person who has the older car, not a new car, and just another means of helping them be aware that they need to check the back seat to make sure they're not inadvertently leaving a child in the car.
And I appreciate that. I think that's a good thing. I think the sad aspect of this, though, is the fact that we got to figure out why the child is not being prioritized. You know, that's another conversation with another group of professionals. But I mean, still, you know, we're you know heading off to work, but we're not thinking about the people that we're working for at home. You know, our family, our children, and you know, and to me, part of that is the lack of like interaction with that child and with the loved ones. You know, it's just why is it so easy that we blot them out of our mind that, you know, they end up in this situation? And like you said, it's not on purpose, but we do need to kind of look at that.
Yeah, and we're very distracted as a society. We have cars that have cell phones, and you get on. We had a situation where a neighbor told her friend that she'd take her child to daycare. She takes the child, gets in the car, the phone rings. She's on a conversation, and she forgets to take the child. She goes to work. Same thing like the father comes out at the end of the day. And that. So we're very distracted on the phone and texting and, you know, all of this. So in addition to requiring the device, my bill would have required the daycare center to call the parent to say the child did not arrive at its expected time. Now, I can remember when my children were in high school, I would get calls to say, well, they didn't make it to class today. What's going on? So if you can do that for an adolescent, you certainly ought to do it for a child.
Well, I mean, the issue is broader in terms of, like you were talking about, notifying the parents. The young teenager recently that was killed, one of the things that they said that the – and, you know, we're still getting more information as this case evolves. But one of the things that they said was the mother wasn't notified, supposedly, until 6 p.m. or later that afternoon or evening that the teenager did not make it to school.
And it's too late at that point.
My thing is, I think, and I could be wrong, you know, and I'm dating myself, and you know how old I am because you've known me most of my life, you know, and you know, but when I was going to school, I think if you didn't show up by 9 or 10 o'clock or something like that in the morning, then they were on the phone with your parents, I think, at that point, if I could recall correctly. You know, so, So that was just baffling to me when I heard that. So, but there's so many components to that particular case that baffles me, and that's for another point in time. So,
but I'm going to refile that bill once I get past the election.
Right. So, looking forward to that happening. So, now I wanted to kind of maybe shift gears a little bit because. It is Women's History Month, and you are part of Women's History and Black History here in Central Florida. So I wanted to talk to you about your journey from where you started here in Central Florida, you know, as an educator and other things that you've done in the community to where you are now. And if you could share your journey and things that were, I guess, high points or landmarks for you along the way.
Well, I was born in New Orleans, but I grew up in Dade County, in South Dade County, and graduated from Miami-Dade College there and the University of Miami. And one of the things that I did throughout my undergraduate journey, I always worked, but because my family did not have money, I always had a job. And I worked for a law professor of Miami. He had taught the first African-American woman to enroll at the law school at the University of Miami. And this woman was Gwendolyn Sawyer Cherry, who was a teacher who decided to become a lawyer and then who ran for the Florida legislature. She won in 1970, more than 50 years ago. She became the first African-American woman to ever be elected to the Florida legislature. The law professor that I worked for contacted her and said, I have this young woman working for me, and she would be terrific as your aide in Tallahassee. Well, my husband was going to law school in Tallahassee at Florida State University, and when Representative Cherry offered me the job, I was elated. And so I went to Tallahassee as her aide and worked for her. She was the only African-American woman in the Florida legislature. That happened, as I said, in 1970. And we, in terms of diversity, our office to her, Mr. Joe Lane Kershaw from Miami as well, had been elected to the Florida House of Representatives in 1968. So it was just those two people. So I began to watch how she was able to change things for people, to change things in society as a member of the Florida legislature. And unfortunately, she died in an accident, a tragic accident in Tallahassee in 1979. And there was a special election held, and she was the person who succeeded her was Carrie Patterson Meek. And Carrie Patterson Meek had been born in Tallahassee, the descendant of slaves and sharecroppers, went to Florida A&M University. So I watched these two trailblazing women, and I didn't really think that this was the path for me. So I came to Orlando with my husband after he completed law school, and I went into education. I was a classroom teacher. I was a college professor, a college administrator, and I was interested in preserving African-American history. So I'm the founder of the Wellsville Museum of African-American History and Culture, which is in Paramore, and it's in a historic building that opened in 1929 as a hotel that provided lodging to African Americans during the days of segregation. And we were able, I started a nonprofit organization, we were able to save the building from demolition, to get funding to restore it. And we now operate it as the Wellsville Museum. It was a former hotel, Black-owned and operated, that was listed in the Negro Motorist Green Book, and it attracted people from throughout the nation when they traveled to Central Florida. So you had people like Thurgood Marshall, who stayed at the Wellsville when he came to Central Florida to defend the Groveland Four, and he could not get a room in Lake County. So he drove 40 miles into Paramore and stayed at the Wellsville. Well, two of the things that motivated me to run for office, I had raised my children, and they were in college before I ran. And two of the things that motivated me, when I was at Valencia College, and I was there for 24 years, I started the College Reach Out program to bring low incomes and during the summer. And I raised scholarship dollars for them so that they, after they graduated from high school, they could realize the dream of a college education. The dollars that I was able to raise were matched by Tallahassee. And for over 10 years, it went wonderfully. And then for some reason, the decision was made to no longer fund the program by the folks in Tallahassee. So I went to testify before a committee, to talk to legislators, and I was told that there was no need for a program like that because everybody had an equal opportunity, and there was a level playing field. Well, that was not the reality that I understood. So that was one of the first things that got me to thinking about it. And the Wellsville was the other thing, because when I asked for money to renovate this historic property, I was told that it was located in a slum. It was in a blighted area where there was drugs and prostitution and crime and all of those things. And those things were true, but they were true because nobody had ever made an investment in that area. You know, given that kind of pushback, I said, well, I think we need some folks in Tallahassee who have a different perspective, a different life experience. And so I was initially elected to the Florida House of Representatives in 2006. I served there until 2012. I ran for the Senate in 2012 and was elected there, and I was served in the Senate from 2012 to 2016 and left the Florida legislature in 2016 and came back in 2018, and the seat that was open was in the House. So I went back to the House, and from 2018 to 2022, this was my second term in the House. In 2022, I was elected to the Senate again. So I think that I'm probably, I don't know of any other legislator who has served in both chambers twice. And so I'm on my second term now in the Florida Senate. And my path, I was impacted by Gwendolyn Sawyer Cherry. I was blessed to be able to work for her. And because I knew of the intelligence of a lot of young people who could go to college if they had the money. So I was concerned about making opportunities available for them. And so those are some of the things that led me to where I am now.
Well, we thank you for your journey in taking on the challenges of working in both the House and the Senate. And also, you know, the listening kind of to sometimes that still small voice that says your path is not that way but this way, you know, because you've done a lot with taking on the other path, the one that wasn't originally part of your game plan. So thanks so much for that. We're going to take a quick break. We are here with Florida State Senator Geraldine Thompson, District 15. If you have questions or comments, the number is 516-387-1944. G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We'll be right back.
At Vintage Labs Collection, we are a multifaceted team of medical professionals dedicated to delivering the best quality products to patients. Our mission is to deliver the best supplement and patient outcomes in healthcare environments and consumer homes. Chat with our consulting pharmacists by visiting our website at www.vintagelabscollection.com. Supplements are not highly regulated, but Vintage Labs holds the standards higher than most.
This is Douglas Dobbs of Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community for 29 years with quality funeral and cremation services. Honoring all religions and faiths, we have been here for many grieving families. Whether it's a complete funeral service with a burial or a simple, dignified cremation, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here for you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs. Dedicated to serving our families.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. By the way, I meant to remind everybody when I first got on, and I'm sorry I didn't do it, but I want to remind everybody again today. Today is International Kidney Day. It is the day that you make a decision to get checked if, you know, you haven't had your kidneys checked, get checked, to maybe make some modifications in your diet and game plan, your health game plan, to do better by your health. A lot of things can impact your kidneys. But also, too, to maybe look at your license, see if you are listed as an organ donor, and maybe put down on your license that you wish to be an organ donor in the event that someone is in need of a kidney transplant. As you may recall, if you were listening yesterday, Marion Traynor, that we've had on before, he was on four different lists for organ donations before he was able to, you know, and it took him 11 months before he was able to get a kidney. So today's that day. Also, because the color is green, if you haven't put on some green today yet, or maybe you want to put on a little pin or something, earrings or something, something that has some green, make sure you wear some green today just to honor that day today. So we are back with Senator Thompson. And Senator, what I wanted to ask you about, and I know I don't know how directly or indirectly you're working on any of these issues, but I wanted to ask you about May 20th, which is the day that Florida was made aware of the Emancipation Proclamation. And do you know if there are any efforts by chance to make that a state holiday?
I'm not aware of any effort to make that a holiday. I know that a number of years ago there was an effort to make Juneteenth a holiday, a state-paid holiday. And there was concern about the fact that, yes, the people in Galveston, Texas, learned about the Emancipation Proclamation on June 19th, and therefore that's how we get Juneteenth. but the people in Florida learned about it in May. And it really just depended on where you were when the Union soldiers came along on horseback. President Lincoln had sent them throughout the South to let people know about the end of the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation. And this is what I feel about it. I think we can embrace all of those things, just like we celebrate the 4th of July and celebrate Juneteenth. I don't think it's an either-or situation. I had an event at the Wellsville Museum on December, is the date that Congress ratified the Emancipation Proclamation. What President Lincoln did was an executive order, and it was never ratified by Congress until December 6th. And so some people say, well, December 6th is Emancipation Day. Others say May 20th is Emancipation Day. Then there are those who say that June 19th is Emancipation Day. And as I said, I don't think it's an either or. I think we can celebrate liberty and freedom and justice on all of those days and the Martin Luther King holiday. But I'm not aware of any effort to make May 20th a holiday in Florida. And as I said, the proposal to have Juneteenth be a holiday in Florida was not successful because of individuals' initiatives that wanted it kind of short-sighted, because we can celebrate all of it.
Okay, I understand. All right. I want to also go back to something that you mentioned early on in our conversation about culture wars. Why do you think this has surfaced just so, it seems, vehemently? It seems like everything, whether or not it is about, you know, some sort of cultural differences or whatever, it seems like it's made to be some sort of battle that involves some sort of cultural difference. And I guess what I'm wondering is why I would like to see clearer heads prevail, I guess, in terms of saying, okay, this is about the actual subject and has nothing to do or very little to do with who's involved, male, female, whatever ethnicity, whatever gender, age, so on and so forth. Because, I mean, you can divide that up into so many different, you know, things. How do you think first of all, why do you think this is happening now? You know, and then two, what do you think will get us past it?
Well, I believe that it's happening now because of the 2020 census. Every 10 years, we take account of the people in the United States of America. And so it has been projected for years that America is going to be primarily black and brown. We are going to be a majority-minority country. And the 2020 census bears that out. So you saw all of these things surfacing because the folks who are in control want to stay in control. And so how do you do that? You attack education, you attack sharing history, you attack diversity, equity, and inclusion, all of the things to try to say, we want to go back, you know, make America great again. I don't know who it was great for, but, you know, that kind of attitude to try to take us back to the 1950s, to a time when, you know, women could not be in the legislature, to a time when African Americans were not in the legislature or in so many other areas. So I think that that is why you're seeing it happening now. And the people who are most vehement about keeping things the way they were 50 years ago, those are the folks who are going out to vote. And some of us are lackadaisical, and we sit on our laurels, and you know, we don't have the same kind of commitment, which is why you see a certain segment of the population solidly behind the former president to try to make him president again. You had our governor, he wanted to be president of the United States. So he looked at all of the things that the former president had done, and those were the things that he emulated to try to appeal to the same group of people. But I think that our folks have got to wake up. We've got to get involved. We've got to be committed to going to vote, to participating, because you can be the majority in numbers but not in power. And we saw that happening in South Africa for many, many years, even though black South Africans were there in greater numbers, they weren't in control. So that's what I believe is happening, and that's why you see the backlash, in addition to the fact that we elected a black president not once but twice. And then in 2020, we elected Joe Biden, and we have now the first African-American female vice president of the United States of America.
So I guess one of the things I wanted to find out, because, yeah, a lot of it sometimes has to do with numbers, but also a lot of times it has to do with being vocal, more vocal. What is that phrase that's saying, the squeaky wheel gets the grease? Sometimes it's not necessarily about how many, but it's a matter of, you know, who's got whose ear, you know, and what they're saying and how loud or often that they're saying it. I'm not good in terms of quoting Bible verses or whatever, but it's almost like the story in the Bible where the woman is persistent in terms of asking for something that she wants or needs, especially I think it was the one where she was trying to get healing for her daughter. Mm-hmm. And it was a matter of being persistent, as a matter of being clever enough to say things that would get someone's attention. But one of the things that you have mentioned, and I don't disagree with you, sometimes certain our community is not vocal enough about certain things. You know,
well,
that's
true. And we saw last week, who is an alumna of the University of Florida. He played mm-hmm. football for the Gators, and then he played football for the Dallas Cowboys. When he mm-hmm. discovered that the University of Florida had eliminated its entire diversity, equity, and inclusion department, he was outraged, and he became vocal, mm-hmm. and he was very critical of his alma mater, the University of Florida, and he encouraged the current athletes to speak up, to be vocal, to be involved. And that's not normally what you see from athletes. And you're probably mm-hmm. aware that the NAACP has gone even further and said to athletes, you know, consider going someplace other than Florida. Why would you want to come and bring your talents here when clearly you're not appreciated? So if it's a matter of getting a scholarship and you have two or three choices, the NAACP is encouraging them to make another choice. So being vocal in terms of your decision making, because we can't just we can't accept quietly being done, dismantling mm-hmm. Programs like that are supposed to assist for the most part first time in college people who are the first generation in their family to go to college. To give them support and to be able to retain them. And so, again, as I said, if you attack education and people are not prepared, no matter how great the number is, you still have a competitive advantage.
You know, one of the big things that, you know, has been churning is about book bans and in terms of being vocal, one of the things that I keep saying with regards to books that they decide to keep and books that they decide, especially history books, is like if you have a history book that you've decided that is going to be the norm, you know, maybe we should speak out and say, okay, is that, does that history cover everything? How accurate is that history from everybody's perspective, not just one? When you put in things that deal with Black history, you know, are your, where are your sources coming from? Are they coming from just, you know, official sources, like, for example, maybe, you know, the Library of Congress or whatever, or do you have people who actually have predecessors, ancestors who have lived this history and have, you know, documentation and stories to tell? And I do know for us as African Americans, documentation is a rare thing in some cases, but there is some out there that could be contributed to make this history more accurate. Because if we, you know, if we don't include a lot of, let's say, supplemental reading to go with the history books that have been approved, you know, the true stories are not going to get told.
Well, you know, with any other group of people, we don't have to have supplements. So I'm saying included in the book, included in the textbook. And we should be making sure that the textbooks that are adopted are inclusive. When I went to school, I learned white history, primarily the history of white males. I did not learn about African Americans. I did not learn about the contributions of African American women because it wasn't in the textbook. So you don't ask any other group, well, let's have a supplement here. Let's pass out a brochure. You require that it be in the textbook, and I think that that's what we need to begin to do.
Yes, definitely. We are going to take our final break. We are here with Florida State Senator Geraldine Thompson of District 15 here in Central Florida. And if you have questions or comments, the number is 516-387-1944. G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We'll be right back.
This is Douglas Dobbs, owner and funeral director at Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community with two generations of family funeral service. With the recent addition of my son Brandon, we are here to take care of the needs of Central and West Orlando. From simple cremation to a full burial, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here to help you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Does it appear the long arm of the law is working against you instead of for you? Whom do you call when the boys in blue are pursuing you? When the wrong person behind bars may end up being you? With over 40 years combined legal expertise, Anderson & Welch bring to bear a smart, sound, sensible defense of those caught in what may be the unrelenting grip of the legal system. Turn to Anderson & Welch first to get ahead of trouble, not fall into it, by calling 561-832-3386. That's 561-832-3386. That's Anderson & Welch Law Firm online at andersonandwelch.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are privileged and blessed to have Florida State Senator Geraldine Thompson of District 15 with us. And the number, if you have any last-minute questions or comments, is 516-387-1944. Senator Thompson, we have to start preparing the next generation for your position and other positions. How do we do that? What do we do?
Well, I tell young people that there's so many boards at the city level and the county level that they can be involved in, and they learn the legislative process or how to work in governmental spaces by joining some of these boards. It can be planning and zoning, or, you know, there are any number. So, you know, just kind of look at the boards and decide what would be a good fit for you. And that way people learn who you are. They begin to understand your strengths, your abilities, your accomplishments. And so you become known and you get a base of people who will support you when you run for office. And I firmly believe that we need to be building a bench because I'm ready to go sit on the beach and put my toes in the sand. But mm-hmm. we need people who are dedicated to helping others. Some people are in it for the wrong reason. And I think it's about public service. And so hopefully we can identify people who have already served the community. Sometimes you have people who appear and they're candidates for office and you wonder, well, where have they been? How have they served the community before? And so you need a track record of having served the community before you seek public office. So those are some of the ways you do it. I have interns in my office every year from the University of Central Florida and from Florida State University. And they are legislative interns who get a stipend from the university so that they can live in Tallahassee for the session. They work in my office. They get to know the people who come in and out. They get to know the issues. They get to know how a bill becomes a law, how you get money in the budget for projects in your district. And so that's another way to build the bench. But we really need to be doing that so that we have people who can step in when others of us move off into a different direction.
I want to ask you about a couple of things. First of all, I have to apologize because I hadn't been diligent about checking on what's going on with Wellsville. So I know that this last Saturday that they had Echoes of Jazz concert there at the Wellsville. I wanted to ask you about, you know, how things are going at the Wellsville, and also wanted to get your insight on the Eatonville, the African-American History Museum that is planned for the Eatonville area and the land that's being turned over from the county to Eatonville and that ongoing, I guess you could say, disagreement between Eatonville and Orange County.
Well, things are going well at the Wellsville. We are planning for Juneteenth. Since it's a national holiday, people are more aware of what it is and what it represents in terms of representing freedom and emancipation. And the last of the people to get the news were those in Galveston, and they got it on June 19th. And I believe until all of us are free, none of us are free. So we're getting ready for our Juneteenth celebration. We're going to be at Camping World Stadium on June 15th. That's going to be our kickoff where we will have entertainers and vendors and presentations on our history from 2 until 9 p.m. at Camping World Stadium. We've been rained out for the last 3 years. So this year we're going inside in the air conditioning. And
okay.
We plan to have our culminating activity on June 19th downtown at the Kia Center in the, I guess you could call it the concourse before you go up to your seat center. It's where we're going to be for our culminating mixer, which is going to be called Better Together, and trying to bring all of the African-American groups together for a mixer and, you know, finding out what everybody is doing for the culminating event on June 19th. So things are going well at the Wellsville. And I'm very excited to be working with a 9-member task force. 3 members were appointed by the governor, 3 appointed by the president of the Senate, and 3 appointed by the Speaker of the House. I was appointed by the Senate president, and the 9 members, the 8 other members, we voted on who would chair that task force, and I serve now as chair. And we're looking at the location of a Florida Black History Museum. We're looking at the design for the museum. We're looking at the content of the museum to make sure that it's factual and that it's not distorted or sugar-coated or whitewashed. And we've had several communities come to make presentations to the task force to say, you should locate it here because, well, we did have a presentation from Orange County, Visit Orlando, and the town of Eatonville, which is the oldest black incorporated township in America. So it has significance already with regard to its relationship to African-American history. We have had presentations from St. John's County, St. Augustine in particular, talking about Dr. King's time in St. Augustine there, Fort Mosaic, which was the first free settlement for African-Americans, is in St. Augustine. So they're saying, come to St. Augustine. We've had presentations from places like Opa-locka, and you know, a lot of history in South Florida. But what we're looking for is a place that has significance in terms of African-American history, that has infrastructure, the roads, airports, ways to get there. There was a debate when the National Museum was being developed. Do we put it close to Dr. King's statue, or where exactly do we put it in Washington, D.C.? Well, it's on the Mall, and that's where the people are. So we want a location that people can easily access. What is the track record already for tourists in whatever area it is? And if people aren't going to necessarily come to the museum as a destination in and of itself, if they're already there, would they extend their stay to come to the museum? So we're going to be considering all of those kinds of things, in addition to what kind of financial commitment can we get from the location, those local governments that want it there. What kind of financial commitment are you willing to make to match what the state is going to have to commit to get this done? And then how do we make it self-sufficient? Because the state doesn't want to run an African-American history museum. They want it to be something that is going to be sustainable and to be self-sufficient. So there will be a transition from the state to operation. And we're going to look at the criteria we've come up with March 25th in a meeting with the task force members, and narrow it down to three locations. And certainly we're considering Eatonville. The litigation that's going on kind of puts a kink in things, because I know that the Orange County School Board, which owns the Hungerford land, is being sued by the preserves, the Eatonville community. We don't know when that suit is going to be resolved. So, you know, saying we can commit the land until that's cleared up, we don't really know. But we're hoping that if everybody can come together, that that can be, you know, one of the locations that hopefully, because this is going to be an economic driver. If you have visited the National African American History Museum in D.C., you have to plan for months to get in there, because, you know, it's always full. And people come and they buy souvenirs, they buy food. You know, it's just an economic engine. And that's why so many locations would like to see it in their community.
Senator Thompson, you have been a blessing. Thank you so much for taking the time out and catching us up. We really appreciate it. You take care.
Oh, all right, and you too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And thank you. Thank you all for listening. This has been G's Power Hour. I never had it so good entertainment. I am your host, G. Tomorrow is Friday in the Garden. Be well, be safe, be blessed. Hug a loved one, and please remember, all real power comes from God. Take care.